sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Mixed market signals, Yellen reverses course, and biotech's bludgeoned. All this and much more on episode number 431 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, and how are you? Andrew Horowitz here, coming down to the end of September 2015, where we've seen a pretty rocky market throughout the month and the quarter. Could be one of the worst quarters in a very long time after we have mixed signals by the Fed, as well as all sorts of, well, squishy information out of China, and of course, all the other headwinds that are hitting stocks due to the rally in the U.S. dollar, also the issues with commodities and the concern about earnings moving forward. So there's lots of things that investors have to really look at these days and be concerned about. Fortunately, we have we saw that John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, stepped down. And he resigned last week, which will possibly lead to a little bit less anxiety over the potential for a government shutdown, even though it seems that there is the desire for the government to, the Republicans to put in a anti-abortion little doohickey inside of the bill to sustain the government's budget and potentially keep the government running. So that's not really a good thing. But who knows what's going to end up happening right now with regard to what the Republicans or what the Democrats are going to try to slip in the actual budget bill to keep the government running. But, you know, even so, this whole government shutdown thing that we've seen time and time again, year in and year out lately, and the whole battle to the end and the potential for this shutdown ends up coming to the last few minutes, and then we get an extension bill to keep the government rolling for another few months. So I'm really not that concerned. Seems to me that this is just a ploy to give them something to bicker about, and in a time when they just can't agree on anything. So I'm not too worried about that. There are some things that have been happening, though. There are some concerns that I do have with regard to the current market structure and how it's been actually playing out recently. Because if you take a look at some of the recent action when it comes to the markets, the technicals in particular, you have to wonder what is going on. Clearly, distribution is at hand. We are seeing that each and every time there is a rip to the upper side of a particular level of resistance, sellers step in and really waxed out stocks pretty badly. We saw this in particular on Friday. On Friday, it looked like things were, well, getting a little bit better after Janet Yellen's speech on the previous night, and the markets opened up nicely positive. And throughout the day, things got weaker and weaker towards the, I would say, about 1:30, 2 o'clock hour on Friday afternoon. Everything fell apart. Biotechs got just torpedoed. We'll talk about that in a second. We also saw that the NASDAQ fell precipitously. The Dow was able to hold on because there was a couple of components like the banks that did very well on Friday, and Nike in particular did very well, reaching an all-time high after their earnings release that showed that they had not only beaten both on earnings and revenues, but their expected back order or their future orders were going to be much greater than anticipated. And one of the things that really stood out was the amount of sales and the sales growth for China. A lot of concern has been going around about the slowdown in China. And this is just one small area that shows that China's, at least their consumption, is possibly better than anticipated. The problem is its consumption once again with a U.S. company. And what I mean by that is that you have to wonder if some of the spending that's going on by consumers in China is directed at things like the iPhone, let's say, or Nike sneakers, or particular clothing that is Western not Eastern. In other words, the money that is flowing is going from the Chinese into non-Chinese companies. And therefore, that's possibly what is causing some of the slowdown where they expected that a lot of consumption would be localized. And that also flies in the face of the concern about the higher dollar. Because if the higher dollar was a concern, they would be buying more local. But that doesn't seem to be really playing out right now. So it remains to be seen what's going on in China, but there was a glimpse of hope with the fact that Nike's earnings were good and that there was that major expansion and expectation for further expansion in China moving forward. So that was good. Anyway, let's recap a few things and then get back into some of the more important items that are going on right now. And particularly, we'll talk about market structure, the whole idea of what's happening in terms of the reversals that we're seeing and what that really should tell you and what you should understand from that. We'll talk about some economics. Next week, we have a great guest, John Stein, who is the CEO of Betterment. And Betterment is one of the, I would say probably the one of the first, I guess the first robo-advisors, robo-investing, where you have very little participation of an advisor or no participation or no intervention or no communication with an advisor. You just kind of go on the web and you answer a few questions. And then what happens is you get these model portfolios that they create for you. And then what you do is just simply put your money in and it does some rebalancing. We'll talk about that more next week and some of my things that I like about it, as well as some of my concerns about that particular investment style. But let's move on to some of the things that are going on in terms of the economy that we saw last week. And actually, there was a few pieces of information that were pretty good and a couple that were negative. But let's go over some of this. One of the ones that I was most surprised with was the consumer sentiment index. It moved above the last few that we've seen in terms of the revisions. The final September University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index came in at 87.2. It initially had a first read of about 85.7. Unfortunately, it was one of the worst final readings that we see since October of 2014. And while it was better than expectations, the fact still remains that consumer sentiment is sliding. And a good amount of that probably is due to some of the whipsawing in the markets, in the stock market. And some of it may be the news headlines that we're seeing from much of the concern about what's happening around the world, the refugee issue with Syria, the concern about the obvious areas of the government shutdown, just all the things that go into why consumers get concerned. At the same time, probably a good reason why it's being held up so well is the employment situation. We continue to see that the initial claims that are released on Thursdays have been coming in really good. I mean, it really is showing that the United States employment situation is moving better and better each and every time that we see a new release. And this Friday coming up will be the next official unemployment rate and numbers from the Labor Department with regard to how well the unemployment situation or employment situation is going. We're currently at a 5.1 level, and it does seem that the Fed is pretty convinced that we're going to be moving even better, where I would say for all of the concern that we had been seeing about the employment situation, where we are in terms of slack in the economy, it would appear to me that right now we are, I would say, very close to full employment, considering all the aspects of technology and robotics, et cetera. I think we're very, very close to that mark. And I think that the Fed is seeing that as well. And that's why they have been hinting or signaling that the potential for a rate hike this year is very, very strong. When it comes to the real estate sector and home building and what's going on in that area, that's of course a very important area when it comes to our economy here, because it really is a important area in terms of employment, in terms of commodities, in terms of just the overall benefit of wealth, because a lot of money is tied up into homes. We saw that new home buying increased 5.7 during the month of August. And the sales pace was the strongest measured by the Census Bureau since February 2008, which is kind of cool. New home sales were up 21% year over year, which was kind of good. This is interesting because in contrast to this, now we're talking about new home sales, existing home sales were down 4.8% last month. That's kind of a head scratcher, isn't it? See that new home sales, I guess a lot of people who were thinking about buying a home finally realized that, hey, wait, the Fed is talking about a rate hike here. Maybe what we should do is get off our keisters and go do something. But still, that doesn't entirely tie out because you would think that people are looking to sell their house and then buy a new house or somehow move from maybe an apartment into an existing home would possibly do that as well. And you wouldn't see that there was that much of a disparity between the new home sales and the existing home sales, because really at the end of the day, the process is the same, right? You know, if I'm thinking, well, interest rates will be going up and, you know, I've been waiting a long time to do something, anything. I'm going to go do something. What, again, I'm just generalizing here. I'm going to do something and I'm going to go buy a house. And, you know, I'm just looking around. I mean, there's plenty of people that want a new home. There's plenty of people that want to buy an existing home. And I don't know necessarily if one is better than the other. Obviously, new homes are better for the home builders. No question about that. Better for the construction industry, of course. Better for the economy overall. But existing homes, you could say, are also good because a lot of times what happens is you get remodeling. You get new things that are purchased. And when you're selling a home, you may have to do a lot of things that you're fixing up before you sell the home. So there's not as much of a dollar amount in terms of new investment in an existing home as it is a new home. But still, you would say that the existing home business really, I think, would really benefit things like companies like Home Depot and Lowe's, Bed Bath & Beyond, et cetera. Whereas the existing home buildings would help commodity prices, theoretically lumber, copper, as well as the home builders. But for whatever reason, we're seeing that in terms of new homes, a lot more desire right now and a lot more money going into that side of the equation. I don't know if there's a particular reason for that. Like I said, I can't come up with anything. Maybe if you can, let me know. Send me a note, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and tell me what you think about that. Durable goods retreated, backed up about 2%. And this was right on with consensus. And one of the things that was interesting was that that the core durable goods orders, when you exclude transportation, because transportation includes airlines and it can be very, very wavy. What happens is that if you have a big order that comes in and you get delivered, you could have a major spike because the valuation of that order of an airplane is very high. And that could really change around the CPI number. So what you do is you pull out transportation from, not from CPI, excuse me, from durable goods. You pull it out and you pull out transportation. And what happens is that you get a much more smooth relation to the previous numbers and on a year-over-year basis. So I think the durable goods issue is something that I watch rather closely. You know, I look at employment, I look at durable goods, I look at factory orders, and I look at inflation as something that's is pretty important. And retail sales is something else. So when you put those particular economic indicators together, I think you get a much better view of the economy and what's going on. But when you look at the big daddies of the economy, you have to look at, of course, employment and GDP. So GDP was actually revised higher for the second quarter. The overall GDP moved up to 3.9%, where it started out at I think it was 2.7% initially, the first reading of the GDP. So that's pretty good. One of the big things was that residential construction grew at about 9.3% pace in the quarter, and we saw that business investment was at about a 5.2% rate. And consumption, which was the big issue, that really was the big issue that helped push GDP a little bit higher. In terms of what happened last week with equities, I think it was a pretty, I would say, disappointing week overall. While each of the major indices were down, Dow was down about 0.5%, S&P down about 1.3%, NASDAQ almost 3% for the week. I think the most disappointing factors involved were, I think Friday was a big disappointment. I got to tell you, that major reversal really smells very funky. You know, what's going on? Was it just simply that nobody wanted to hold over the weekend to wake up on Monday morning and, you know, have, you know, futures down, you know, even a small amount after maybe there's some weird announcement, you know, from China or maybe something going on in Syria? There's some notes about France, you know, doing some airstrikes and some other countries possibly joining in. But the velocity of the move lower on Friday from being up initially to closing down on the day, still above the Thursday low, which was a good thing. It really is concerning that we're seeing such a broad-based selling that has been really, I would say, nonstop for some time. And again, this really smells directly like it's just nothing more than distribution and lightening up on positions that were over-leveraged, over-margined, and concentrated. One of the big things that really dragged down the NASDAQ last week was biotechs. Now, this all stems from the tweet that Hillary Clinton had where she talked about how she was going to really get on the bandwagon and start to really attack the drug companies for unfair pricing and gouging of their pharmaceuticals and their medicines, et cetera. And it was done in a very broad brushed approach, and it was such a I guess a surprise to many, and that there could be some kind of very strict regulations on the cost of medicines, therefore stifling innovation, research, and the potential for discovery of new drugs, and at the same time really constraining the potential earnings of companies who have spent a lot of money on their research. And I'm not defending them. Listen, I'm not defending the fact that, yeah, one particular drug may cost, I don't know, $50,000, $60,000 for a particular disease. And that may seem to us, looking at it from a financial standpoint, very expensive. Now, of course, if it's life-saving, if it's something that is involved in prolonging of your life, I'm sure you or I will pay that somehow. We'll figure out how to get the money. But when looking at it on just a simple dollars and cents standpoint, you say, wow, that's a tremendous amount of money that people are paying for this. And what drug is really worth it? Where is it that it's a payback for the research and the profitability of the company? And where is it just, you know, simply gouging? And we did see that this was spurred on by a particular company that raised the price of their drugs, I don't know, like 5,000% overnight. A drug that's been around for, you know, 40 years, I think it was. And all of a sudden, a hedge fund manager took control of the company and decided that, you know what, we need to make more money with this company. And we're going to take this drug that's been around for a while to treat some kind of a bacteria or some crazy situation where, you know, I think 2,000 or so people per year take this drug, and it went from like $15 a pill to some ridiculous number per pill. And that was the start of this. And ever since then, as Hillary Clinton tweeted that she was going to do this and come out with a plan that maybe she was going to look to start putting in some kind of legislation when she was president, that if she becomes president, that would limit the cost of medicines or maximize the maximum amount of out-of-pocket for prescription drugs would be $250 per person. The big question is, well, who gets stung with the rest? Is it the insurance companies? Or is it going to be something along the lines of trying to break the back of the biotech companies and of the pharmaceuticals? So they came down. I mean, they came down over the last couple of weeks very, very rapidly. These are one of the sectors that was holding up the entire NASDAQ and has had the NASDAQ outperforming for some time. And if you look at some of these stocks, their prices have really gone up nicely and just crashed over the last couple of weeks. There was a bit of a track back on these anyway as markets were correcting over the last few months. But really, I think the IBB and the NASDAQ Biotech Index probably had its worst day in 2015 on Friday. Why Friday? Why did it do so poorly? It looked like it was the end of the shakeout that was going on recently, that there was a lot of people saying, forget it. You know what? We can't get this thing moving. There's going to be legislation. I'm all concerned. I'm all scared. I'm not looking at anything more than I just want to lock in profits, and boom, it just slid. Plus, we did fall through some technical resistance in terms of levels that I did see there. So I think that did help to spur on some of the selling. And that's why the NASDAQ did so much more towards the negative side than the Dow or the S&P last week. When it comes to this whole notion of the cost of drugs, you know, clearly you would wonder, as I mentioned before, that, you know, who would take shoulder the expense of this? Because if we look at innovation, clearly we do see that the opportunity for profit is helping to provide a great deal of interest, money flow, and backing to companies in the biotech industry. And we only talked about this a few months ago. We talked about how, wow, you know, over the last 2 years, the incredible breakthroughs that have been made in terms of life prolonging medicines has been amazing. The speed at which now discoveries are being made and to the level they are, we're talking about something that looks very promising for Alzheimer's. We're seeing that Merck and Pfizer, Biogen, Gilead. We saw the eradication of hepatitis C recently. I mean, just a lot of things going on for all sorts of different diseases. And all of a sudden, they take this time to attack the industry. You have to wonder, you know, if this is going to be something that gets swept under the rug or it's going to continue to just reverberate because, you know, this is something that we want to, of course, you know, there never should be any money made at this level by anybody because it's just fleecing the American people, right? The theory of the Democrats or maybe some of the Republicans. And generally, politicians will try to take these kind of situations and expand them for their platform, especially now that we're in a, you know, in the a point of a countdown to a presidential election. Just seems to me very messy at this point. And you would think that market participants are pretty aggravated with Hillary Clinton now for her very, I think, ill-timed and very, you know, lack of any kind of thought about really the background of all this. And I'm not making a political statement because I could make plenty on both sides right now. I'm just talking about the concept of what the, you know, this comment did. I just think the industry is going to probably strike back very soon with a lot of a tremendous amount of background information to try to explain what's going on. She made some really good points, by the way. One of the things she talked about was the incredible amount of advertising to the public. You know, all those ads that you see. I've talked about this so many times on DH Unplugged. Like, you look at, have you watched CNN? And almost every commercial is about Cialis or some other medicine. And these commercials are really long. They're spending an awful lot of money on advertising. I do agree with that. I do agree with the companies that are spending more on advertising than they are on research. That's probably a concern too for those companies that are involved in R&D of new drugs at any level. So there's some things that were brought up here, but I think the broad brush approach and the sell-off that investors did to this sector right now is a little bit overdone, or at least coming to a point that it's overdone, and has been unselective. In other words, it's been just broad-based selling of the, you know, indices, selling of the ETF, and that's just bringing down every single one of them. But if you look at some of the big names, I mean, the opportunity that they have moving forward, even with, you know, some of the potential backing down of the costs of the drugs that they sell, still, I mean, they have a great pipeline and there's a great opportunity there. So keep a watch on the biotech area and the ETFs, some of the core stocks that are really well, like, doing well, like I mentioned some of the names a moment ago. I think that's something you want to take a look at, like a Celgene, Amgen, you know, to keep a look at Biogen, of course. You know, you may see some further shakeout here, but there will be a buy point coming in. I think the realization will hit that these are still very, you know, high quality companies, good pipeline, tremendous R&D, and very worthwhile overall in terms of the structure of their meds and what they are doing for the population and for humanity, frankly. All right, let's finish off this section with what's going to be happening coming up next week. Monday, August consumer spending, and we're going to see the pending home sales index. Tuesday, it's kind of important, the July Case-Shiller Home Price Index, as well as the Conference Board September Consumer Confidence Index is going to be there. We're going to see earnings from companies like Diamond Foods, Costco on Monday. I think, actually Tuesday, excuse me, on Tuesday we'll see Costco. Watch Costco. I think it's going to really be a tell on whether some of the dire concerns from Walmart that we saw recently are going to really be spilling over and are truly going to be a sector issue if it does hold for Costco as well, or if it is just Walmart specifically. So keep a watch on the numbers from Costco, but more importantly, their outlook. I think that's going to be something that's going to be a good tell in terms of the consumer. As I mentioned earlier, we saw that consumer sentiment was, you know, okay, definitely falling from where it was. But still, I think that some of these retail numbers are going to become very important this week. On Wednesday, you're going to see ADP's job change report from September. You're going to see information regarding earnings on from Paychex. And we're going to have another speech from Janet Yellen. She's going to talk at a banking conference in St. Louis. And on Thursday, we're going to see the September factory PMI from ISM, the September Challenger job cut report, and, of course, those initial claims that we see each and every Thursday. And, of course, Friday, we'll see the September employment report. One of the things I'll mention now, I guess, probably would be something that we really should discuss is what happened with Janet Yellen on her during her speech last Thursday. If you haven't followed this or watched this, it was quite fascinating because, you know, Janet Yellen, who is the most powerful central banker, probably second to her would be, I guess, and I wouldn't say Stanley Fischer in the U.S., but it would probably be Mario Draghi, obviously. Then you'd have Shinzo Abe in Japan. But she gave a speech, and she gave a very long speech, a presentation. I think it was 40 pages or so with slides and all sorts of material backing up the whole thesis on where the Fed stands and the whole idea of being data dependent and where the unemployment situation is and you know, how, of course, the central bank and why, of course, they have held back so far, et cetera. But during her speech towards the end of it, as she had said, as she started talking about that she now supports, this is interesting, this is a big turnaround, she now supports a rate hike by the end of 2015, where, if you remember, just a week earlier, she had talked about holding off due to a variety of different uncertainties, and markets initially reacted very favorably and then turned to the downside. And then since then, markets are down like 5%. Very confusing in terms of what they're talking about, because they talk about that some market participants said there should be a rate hike by now. Then we had a variety of Fed speakers come out and talk about how, you know, we need a rate hike at this moment. And then the Fed doesn't do it. Big wonder why. Was it, you know, more of a concern about the, you know, things outside the U.S.? Are things a lot worse than we think? Is there going to be contagion? Is it going to be coming over here into the United States? Very, very confusing what they're talking about, because they brought up a few things that were not part of their base mandates, which essentially are employment and inflation. Now, one of the things that was really interesting was two things. First, that Janet Yellen said that there's probably going to be, you know, there should be a rate increase, or she is behind and supports a rate increase by the end of the year. Now, remember, the Fed has been drilling in our heads that they are data dependent, data dependent. They're going to do this dot plot of where each of the members stands as they look at all the data that's coming out. So each and every data point that comes out has obviously been disrupting markets, because you look at one data point and it looks positive and you say, okay, they're going to raise. You see another data point and, oh, look how terrible that number is. Well, they're not going to raise. And this has been going on for months now. And all of a sudden, Janet Yellen is now saying, well, we're going to raise by the end of the year. Well, what happened to being data dependent? What happened to that whole discussion that you had told us to live by? How now are all of a sudden you date dependent rather than data dependent? Talk about confusing. Now, you have to remember that if that were only what happened, if that was the only thing that happened during that speech, I think that, you know, generally speaking, there would be a sense of relief that there was some clarification from her previous testimony and statement by the Fed, their rate hike decision and the press conference that followed, because a lot of people were expecting that things were okay and fine and we raised rates. It was really kind of pathetic, I thought, that they actually did so just a week later. I would say it's reversing course, but at least it's, if you want to say it's providing clarification, okay, I can go with that. But still, it's just very confusing. They seem to be very much market dependent rather than date dependent, rather than data dependent. If the markets don't go the direction they want, they seem to change their course. Isn't that really what it looks like? Bit of hocus pocus. Just to try to embody the idea that, hey, the Fed is really looking at the economy. But truly what they're looking at is the whole wealth effect. They don't care about anything else. If the economy follows, great, and hopefully it will. But if not, we'll just keep rates at, you know, such a low point and not move them for years and years and years. Now, at the same time, there was something pretty scary that happened during the speech. At the end of the speech, as Janet Yellen was providing the information and the understanding that she supports a rate hike by the end of the year, all of a sudden, if you watch it, she starts to get a little weird with her words. She pauses. She stops. She seems very confused. Doesn't understand what's on the piece of paper or something, or how could she... At first, you're thinking, man, she probably wants to backtrack. She probably can't believe that she's thinking about raising rates by the end of the year because, wow, you know, that was never the idea she had going into this deal. But then all of a sudden, she started up again talking about maybe 10, 15 seconds later, then paused again, stopped, looked oddly at her papers, looked confused. Something was really weird. Almost looked like she was couldn't see what was on the paper, or maybe she was dizzy or something odd. And then she had some kind of weird coughing and movement at the end of the speech where she actually stopped the speech before the natural end of the speech. Something was clearly wrong. You know, was she having a stroke? Was simply, you know, something that was, she was just a little disoriented. At the time, it was very unclear, very scary. And she did walk off the stage. Then we got reports that she was dehydrated. She was under these lights and this long speech, maybe a pretty tough tour. Although she's been known to do a lot and not have problems. But we'll chalk it up to dehydration, which is the official Fed commentary. But something was definitely not right. So hopefully we wish her well. And hopefully this was just a temporary situation. It was just simply dehydration. She rehydrated and everything will be fine. We'll see more about her condition, if there is one, and what she has to say next week. And assuming that she does keep up with her current schedule, there'll be nothing to worry about because markets are very concerned. She has been very friendly to markets. And while her number two, Stanley Fisher, is rather dovish as well, I don't think we've had as dovish of a central banker. I don't know when. I can't really think back to one that was on the way in and prior to and then seated as dovish as Janet Yellen was. Even Bernanke, he seemed to be hawkish in comparison to Janet Yellen and her current grouping. But again, I think this is a very bad misstep, the way the Fed handled the September meeting. I think they really should have hiked rates at that point. I think it would have done a world of good for the confidence in markets. And even though they did have clarification and you did see futures move up very nicely into that, we saw that European markets were up like 2.5%, 3%. We saw that Asian markets were doing okay. Overall, a little bit of a rebound on certain markets in Asia. And the U.S. markets opened up much higher and then just collapsed. I think that, again, it's this very big uncertainty that has been hovering over the heads of markets as the Fed is getting closer and closer to the date that they're going to raise rates. And they're trying their best to tell everybody that it doesn't matter when we raise rates, it's the process, and we're going to be very elongated in any kind of rate hike process. Maybe we'll do 0.25% now. It may take a year till we do another 0.25%. But I think they need to get this done to relieve some of the tension that has been built up in the markets over the last several months about the anticipation. It's all about the anticipation right now. Just get it over with. Be done with it. Let's shift to some global events that occurred over the weekend that I thought were pretty fascinating. One of the things we saw, besides the Pope has been on all Pope television, been everywhere. He's been visiting all sorts of cities and making friends and spreading goodwill, which has been great. Nice to see that. China also, we saw that Chinese premier was touring and had some meetings with technology leaders and some business leaders, as well as President Obama. Now, one of the things that they vowed together, he and President Obama, was a curb to commercial hacking. A curbing of commercial hacking. There was an agreement with Obama that they will really start to get serious about this. They're going to really, you know, figure out what's going on and stop all this hacking that's going on from China. So I was thinking about that, and I was saying to myself, so if you're going to now say that you are going to somehow clamp down, does that mean that previously you were allowing it? Isn't that the connotation? That the Chinese government was allowing hacking to go on of the U.S., and this was a tolerable endeavor. I mean, you know, why in fact did they say this? Why are they now all of a sudden, yeah, we're going to do something about this? You know, was it just the meeting? No. If you kind of dig through all the stories of the weekend, you'll also note that President Obama said, hey, you know what? We're just going to let you know we are going to support your endeavor to have the yuan, the currency of China, as the potentially in the IMF and as a reserve currency, something that China has wanted for a long time. So essentially what happened was that China said to Obama, yeah, listen, hey, do me a favor. We're going to do our best to implement some kind of mechanism to figure out who these hackers are. These hackers that we've been allowing to operate so freely for some time, it seems, and we're going to stop and eradicate commercial hacking. And you, Mr. Obama, will then tell everybody that you are very much behind the opportunity for the yuan to be included in the world's global currency reserve as a high-ranking currency in a basket of currencies, which is really fascinating that President Obama said that he would support that after the recent manipulation of the currency and after Congress has been cooing for years about Chinese as a currency manipulator. So somehow we got a bogus deal from China that they're going to look into and, you know, find the criminals who are hacking U.S. companies, and a bogus agreement from President Obama that he won't be able to do anything about because all of Congress thinks that China is a currency manipulator, that we will back this whole notion that, yeah, hey, the yuan is a great currency that should be included in the world currency list of reserve currencies, like the yen, like the U.S. dollar, like the euro. What do you think about that crap? Fact is, neither of these parties can really do what they said they're going to do. But I guess it looks good and the optics are good. So when they go back to their constituents, Chinese leader can go back and say, hey, you know what? Good news. The U.S. supports our currency endeavor. They say we're a solid currency. And, you know, you should put your money in our currency, which would, of course, listen, it would help if it did become a reserve currency, what would happen is there would be the potential for greater inflows, which would mean more foreign direct investment and investment in China by foreigners. So that's a good thing for China. They could use that. But they can go back now and say all this great stuff and prop up their whole, you know, all these great things they did. There's something they've been looking for some time. The U.S. does support it. And President Obama can say that, you know, during conversation, you know, he persuaded China to really clamp down on this commercial hacking that's been going on for some time. Not to worry, we got you covered. In the end, neither is true, in my opinion. So I guess we could chalk that up to non-event. Just an absolute non-event, but we talked about it. One of the things that also was really fascinating last week, I think that probably many of you have been touched by, and many of you have been, I think, looking at it with concern, and probably there's a whole bunch of people that are absolutely disgusted. And this is the Volkswagen situation. It seems that if you haven't been keeping up with this very quickly, Volkswagen cheated on the emissions reporting for their clean diesel products on their Volkswagens, Passats, Audis. I mean, their Volkswagens and Audis and a variety of different models. And the concern was that they seemingly were able to figure out a way in which they could do the test through, you know, the EPA tests that were required, but somehow come out that in whatever particular mode it was that was high efficiency in terms of the diesel fuel, it was very low emissions and very environmentally friendly. So when you combine an environmentally friendly car with high mileage and with diesel, which is more powerful than regular gasoline, and it's clean burning, you've got something special. I think 50% of the sales of Volkswagens or 50% of the sales of cars in Europe are diesel. Much lower here in the United States. But since this all began, this lying that went on, I think about 11 million cars were sold that have this problem. Now, if you're going to make the change and there's some kind of change that you can make to your car, if you have this, you're going to lose a potential, I think, 10 miles to the gallon or so. And if you want to put it into this true mode that will be energy efficient. And it may have to be some retrofitting that goes on, etc. But Volkswagen admitted the wrongdoing. They admitted they knew about this. And obviously it was more than just one person somehow that was able to cheat the whole system. It was a company specific, at this point, a company specific situation that was essentially a conspiracy. I mean, really, it was a company conspiracy that withheld this information and lied. And now you have all sorts of problems that are going to emanate from this. Some of the things that I've been thinking about have been, of course, the resale value of any existing cars. The second thing is the gas mileage, the cost to the consumer of that, and the potential class action lawsuits that go with that. And of course, with the resale value, the class action that goes along with that. Then you have the environmental fines that will happen. Who knows what that's going to be? $10 billion, $15 billion? That they'll be fined by the EPA for misleading and for polluting beyond the scope of what they said was the limit, et cetera. Of course, you have a variety of other things that can happen. For example, sales, the mistrust in the company. You have a natural distaste for the company right now, so their sales could plummet, if nothing else, of clean diesel cars, which is a big component of their sales. On top of that, you have their leased products. You have a car that's leased. Their residual value goes to hell in a handbasket. All the lenders that were expecting to take back those cars and then resell them at a certain rate where you look at the the residual value. So if you have, for example, a car that's, I'm just giving you a number here, $20,000, and in 3 years, the residual value is 50%, $10,000. Well, now that clean diesel could be a residual value of $5,000. So those leasing companies that were expecting to sell the car and make back some of their money and some of that, you know, after the lease was up, is really in trouble. And Volkswagen Credit, of course, was a lease company that did finance some of those leases or a good chunk of those. So Volkswagen has a real problem on their hands. Class action lawsuits, a write down of their leasing operations, and global emissions fines they'll have to pay from many places around the world. Now, on top of that, they'll have also a loss of the character and the potential of trust, and that will just lead to a sales decline. Now, here's the big problem. This is a big part of Germany's overall production. This is not funny. This is not just a little bitty car company we're talking about here. This is a major player in German economics in terms of hiring, in terms of materials, and you kind of have to move down the list also of all the suppliers. You have to look at also, you know, what this is going to mean in terms of profitability and how it relates to the stock market. As Volkswagen dropped, I think Volkswagen dropped 25% last week. And as they go and maybe start to have recalls and have to then pay for the now upgrade of those cars, 11 million cars, there's just all sorts of problems that are going to emanate from this. And as Germany is the hub of the Eurozone, you just have to wonder what effect this is going to have on Europe entirely. As Europe was the place, due to all the quantitative easing and the Mario Draghi talk and all of the stimulus that was going to be provided from now for through the next few years, that was the place that was over allocated by many analysts and asset allocation firms. Europe was the place to be. Japan, okay, was slowing down. They were, you know, still doing a lot of stimulus and will continue to do so. You saw the emerging markets having real problems, the commodity-driven markets having real problems around the world, Australia, New Zealand, South America, Russia. China was just a basket case, so you're not even going to bring that up. That's not really the developed world anyway. But now you have, you know, United States that was going to be on a rate hiking, you know, spree potentially, or at least one rate hike, or if nothing else, not doing further stimulus actions. The place to be was Europe. And in Europe, where's the place to be? It's Germany. So we'll see what happens there. But that's a very big concern of mine when you have this kind of broad-scale problem and a company that is so important to the economy of one country. This could really have substantial reverberations for Germany. No question, takes them down a few notches. So anyway, I thought that was a really interesting story. Keep a watch on Volkswagen, the stock. I think it's going to be fascinating how this all plays out because of the multifaceted nature of where you're going to have all of these potential you know, lawsuits, class actions, and governmental agency-based fines that go on. It's going to be pretty ugly. It's going to be very long entrenched. We'll see how quickly people can forget about it and keep the stock afloat. And we just have to look back to a company like a GM to see how that goes. You know, GM was a much different animal with the ignition system. Of course, it was causing deaths. And I don't think there's been any reported deaths due to Volkswagen's cheating of the emissions. Although you could theoretically say that it's harmful to all of us and it's a much bigger potential health hazard, but we're not going to get there yet. I don't think they're really going to get to that point yet. Anyway, what else do I have on my list here? Let's see. Did I cover all that? Cover the markets. Good. Covered that. China, biotechs. I mentioned all of those, gave you some stock ideas, Gilead and Biogen, Amgen, Yellen talked about her presentation next week. I think we're getting towards the end of this discussion. Did talk about the government as well with John Boehner. That's good. I think that one of the things you want to take a watch on that next week and really focus in on is currencies. Currencies have been, I would say the yen in particular has been leading the markets up and down. The funding currency in a very long winding trend has been to short the yen and buy U.S. related stocks. And it's interesting because when the yen moves lower in Japan, because they are so export driven and centered around their exporting companies, when the yen moves lower, it becomes much more competitive for them. And as such, what you do see is that their markets generally move higher. It's just the way it goes. It's a kind of a knee-jerk reaction. But the yen moving down does do wonders for their market. The yen moving higher is very tough on their markets. It used to be that the dollar moving lower was also pretty good for the U.S. markets. There was a time there. And then all of a sudden, we turned around to where the stronger dollar was actually a much better condition, whereas the yen was being sold, dollar being bought, money flowing into the U.S. And of course, the U.S. being stronger because their GDP is good, we're entering into a pretty good overall economic growth, or continuing with economic growth, not slowing down at all from any particular statistic that you can look at, employment doing better, and the Fed on the way to hike. So all things were pointing towards a higher dollar, and that really aided the U.S. stock market, which was really interesting because now we're seeing that a lower dollar hurts the market, hurts equities, which is exactly opposite of what happens in Japan and exactly opposite what happens in Europe. So Europe is on a stimulus binge, just like Japan, and they really need their currency to be lower. And that has been very helpful to their overall competitiveness. And if you look at what has actually happened in terms of competitiveness, just look no further than Caterpillar. Now, again, you could say, well, Andrew, well, you just talked about Nike in the beginning of this discussion, how well they did, even with the dollar moving higher. Well, yeah, that is true. But when you look at a different level, the industrials, and how they've really been hurt, particularly those that deal in anything related to commodities, and that's Caterpillar, of course, with their mining operations and with the building and infrastructure development around the world. I mean, Caterpillar, look at that stock. I mean, they came out with a major warning and a layoff of about 10,000 people last week, and the stock went down like 6 or 7% to, I think, a multi-year low, back to, I think, 2011. And this is, I think, a big divergence with expectations, whereas you would have an economy that is moving ahead, you would think the industrials would do very well. But the problem is it's really showing the outside weakness, ex-consumers in the big ticket industrial style investing. So I think people are much more inclined to buy for themselves their things that they need and they want, and their, you know, things that they wear, the food they eat, the phones they talk into, computers. But when it comes to everything outside of that, it seems to be at a standstill. And of course, Caterpillar in particular has a lot of competition outside the U.S. that has, you know, I'm not quite sure, but I don't think that a government is going to really care what particular bulldozer they buy, as long as it can do the job and if the price is right. I don't think it's as statusy as wearing a Nike shoe or having an Apple phone, right? It's not like, hey, look at that, Mr. Mayor. I got a Caterpillar. Yep. What are you driving? It's not like that. So they're really looking at the price points, and those are the companies that are really struggling. So keep watching that divergence between the consumer goods and those things that are statusy, rather than those materials, objects, and devices that maybe are more of a commodity type of device that could be bought somewhere else, whether it's a bulldozer, crane, or any other capital good. All right, we're going to end it there. I want to thank you for joining me, and I wish you well. Next week, we'll have this great guest coming on, and next weekend, for part of the weekend, I'm going to be actually out in Montauk, Long Island, for the striper run. This is the striped bass. It's kind of, they come in this time of year. Going to spend some time out in my old stomping grounds where I used to spend every summer. If you haven't been there, it's a cool place. Tip of Long Island, New York, all the way out there, as far east as you can get on the South Fork. And I'll be there a couple of days. But we'll make sure to have a podcast running. And, of course, listen in on DH Unplugged. I think this week's going to be very interesting, as we missed last week due to the holiday. So we'll see you then. And thanks again for joining me. Check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com. This episode show notes will have some of the stocks we mentioned, as well as some links and some other things you need to know. Otherwise, I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.